Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. We're taping to play this on Christmas Day, but since when you listen to it, if you hear it live, let me wish you a Merry Christmas. Not this year, but maybe. Well, I wish you a Merry Christmas this year. There isn't very much to be cheerful about this Christmas that I can find. The maybe that I broke off was, the maybe was that maybe next year a Merry Christmas will have a lot more meaning than it does this year. Oh, my goodness. In any event, let me tell you about my guest, an important topic, and listeners to this program understand, and if there are any new ones, and they don't, they'll certainly understand those cryptic comments that I made by the time this hour is over. My guest is Henry Giroux. Henry holds the Global TV Network Chair Professorship at McMaster University up in Canada. He's written many books, many books. He puts out new books almost at the speed that I get out new articles. It seems that way because the last time he was on, we talked about another new book. We're going to talk about still another one today, and he's got even more new books, so we'll get them back for future programs because they're all important and they all need to be discussed. Some of his past ones include The University in Chains, that is, Against the Terror of Neoliberalism, Is It Ever Terror?, Youth in a Suspect Society, that's what we talked about last time. And the new one we'll talk about today is, I love the title, Henry, Zombie Politics and Culture in the Age of Casino Capitalism. The Living Dead, he talks about. you know, those people that run the world. They run the country, they run the world. I refer to them, Henry may talk about our zombie politics and culture. I like to talk about a criminal cabal, a combination of what we call our government and the business community with its beating heart, or maybe its brain, or a combination of the two, headquartered in Wall Street. And Henry, one more comment, then I'll let you jump in, because this is something that that grates on me, I think, every moment I spend awake. And I haven't used your metaphor, but I've certainly written about this stuff, and it keeps eating at us, and it's destroying us, and I've made that point over and over again. And if the beating heart and brain is on Wall Street, I think probably many people, if not most listeners to this program, remember one of the ugliest quotes I ever heard. I just can't imagine a quote much uglier than this. Maybe some as ugly, but this was pretty ugly. You know the guy who heads up Goldman Sachs, which may be the heart and the brain of that brain hot beast on Wall Street. This guy, Lloyd Blankfein. If ever a guy ought to be behind bars wearing striped suits, vertical striped suits, I guess they are. It's this man, and when he was once questioned about the results of his handiwork and his company and the entire street, his comment was that they were doing God's work. Well, I don't know who he prays to, but it's not the God I learned about when I was growing up. Anyway, Henry, I've been giving long introductions lately, but what a terrific subject to talk about. And doing it on Christmas Day, I think people need a cold shower on Christmas Day. You know, everybody will see the lights and all the joy and goodwill and all that stuff. Well, point it out to me, because I can't seem to find any. Henry, you jump in and talk about your book.
You're so right. I mean, the pure arrogance in that statement, the kind of moral insensitivity, the revolting indifference to human life that actually you would think the holiday spirit should embody seems to be so at odds with any understanding of how politics or democracy or social welfare or social justice actually works in this country, that he's symbolic of really what I call, you know, this kind of zombie politics. I mean, these are people who really reduce life for most people to a form of social death. And I think that what the zombie metaphor does is that it suggests more than the symbolic face of power. It kind of points to what I say in the book is a kind of mad agency, you know, that is like a new form of death in life. I mean, everywhere these people go, they spread violence. Everywhere they go, and with every move they make, you see massive and increasing amounts of human suffering, and a philosophy that is so cool, it is unlike anything that we have seen before, and really marks a new age. And Stephen, I'll give you an example, which I know you know about. This thing that just happened in Arizona, where the Republican governor of Arizona and legislature has decided to cut off from its Medicare program people who receive transplants, certain transplants. There are 100 people that were on the waiting list for that, for those transplants. Many of them will now die if they don't get the transplants. It saved something like 0.1% of their budget. Now, this truly is the death march. I mean, this is truly the politics of disposability, where you have people who no longer have enough wealth to be able to consume basic services, who are now viewed as actually as excess, as not worth living. And I think if anything embodies a kind of zombie culture, that even more so than the hypocrisy of the statement that the rich are doing God's work sort of reveals what's going on. But there's also another story. Sorry, I'm sort of taking you off on this too. And the other is another story that I know you know about. And this was in Tennessee, which really exemplifies the state of the social state in America as opposed to the punishing state, where a house was burning, and they called the fire department. The fire department came out, and because this was not a pay-for-service customer, they watched as the house burned down and joked. Three animals died in that house, in that fire. This is unbelievable. I mean, to think that we live in a country where political power and economic power now reign in a body of limited, in a limited number of people in corporations that can allow this to happen, and we don't have massive public outrage, it's just very hard to understand.
Oh, absolutely, Henry. I say it over and over again on this program that with all going on, I mean, even people who don't do what I do and what you do, people have some idea of the horrors going on in this country. I mean, you see it at the level of unemployment and people losing their homes and going through hard times. They see the stock market go up, but their personal state is getting worse and worse. And literally millions of people in this country are one paycheck away from maybe being out in the street. I mean, they're that close to the edge. And I say, where is the level of anger? What will it take to get people mad enough to say, I'm not going to take this anymore? And we hear the parade of politicians, I think especially the so-called liberal Democrats. I can't find any liberal Democrats. I honestly can't find any. The high-minded statements they make all the time, Henry. That high-minded hypocrisy. And then when it comes to voting time, it's a whole other animal, and the only time they get a pass to maybe, if they have one, to vote their conscience, Henry, is when their vote doesn't mean anything. So even a guy, I've mentioned this guy's name many times in this program, maybe the so-called best of the best in the Senate, Henry, Bernie Sanders, who went through a useless exercise a week ago Friday, a long speech, against Obama's tax cuts. It was absolutely meaningless. It was a waste of time. It was grandstanding. Well, they didn't need his vote, so he was one of the 19 senators that voted against it. But if his vote was needed, he would have voted for it the way he did for health care, which is an atrocity It literally makes the present system work. And he was the only senator, Henry, who introduced a universal health care bill. He had no co-sponsors. He was all by himself, and he was high-minded day after day, month after month, and he was the 60th vote, the most important vote he's ever cast in the Senate. His vote, had it been no instead of yes, he could have shot the whole thing down for the right kind of a health plan that we all need and deserve, but he surrendered. All of that rhetoric was a waste of time. It was a sham. And he did it.
You know, actually, I have a somewhat different take on it. I mean, I think it was a sham in that it didn't change policy, but I think it was inspiring in some ways in that there are people like him and you and others that refuse to allow these contradictions to simply slip into a kind of utterly depoliticizing form of cynicism. I mean, while the contradictions are there, so the question now becomes, what are the strategies to educate people to be able to realize that it's not in their interest to be able to vote for a system or to believe in a democracy that is really is antithetical to their own interests? And so for me, the question becomes, you know, what is it that we need to reclaim to make these contradictions not only visible, but to mobilize people around a set of politics and a set of interests that actually suggests that we need a third party movement and a different set of alliances in this country in order to explode a political system that is so fossilized, so on the side of bankers and the wealthy and the rich, that it's no longer operable. That we, to even talk about living in a democracy is silly. This is not a democracy. It does not serve the majority of interest, the majority interest in this country. And it's now, and for the most part, one could probably argue that an economic elite of 1% controlled both the country and 99% of the population. So I guess for me, the starting point is, what does it mean to make power visible? I mean, the first order of politics is to make it visible. And at least Sanders is doing that. You're doing it. And we're marginal voices. But I really believe that the only hope we have is to be able to, in some way, shine a kind of theoretical, political, and educational light on these issues in order to, in some way, hope that people can make the connections in which the public, in which private woes become public problems. You know, the old C. Wright Mills notion that this is in part a matter of translation. Politics is in part not just about mobilization, it's about translation. It's about understanding the historical social forces in which we find ourselves. People have to realize that, you know, they can't be blamed for being for massive, when 50 million people don't have, when 20 million people, 20% of the population is unemployed, that's not a personal problem, that's a systemic problem, right?
Oh, absolutely.
When the education system is being sold down the river to corporate interest, that's not about choice. That's about manipulation. That's about corporate manipulation. When Mayor Bloomberg appoints somebody to head a school system with 1.1 million children, and that person has no experience whatsoever except to be basically a corporate CEO, then we know we've reached the limits of what it means to use democracy as a facade to hide corporate power. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes absolute sense. And on the schools, Henry, the same thing was done in Chicago. The guy who was the CEO of Chicago schools replaced, when he went to Washington, Arne Duncan, education secretary for Obama and buddy of Obama in Chicago, and he wrecked the schools by himself. I don't know what background he had in schools, but when he went to Washington, he was replaced by a corporate CEO who knows nothing about education, you know, except to sell it off to business.
Tell me something. What do you make of this? You know, I mean, it's generally agreed publicly that these CEOs, this business culture, this corporate elite created a global recession that is almost unprecedented since the 1920s, right?
Oh, I
And
am,
yet, I, at another level, we point to these CEOs as models of leadership, even in the face of what is now one of the worst economic disasters of our time. I mean, people are aware of the greed, they're aware of the exploitation, they're aware of the systemic trampling on civil liberties, they're aware of all these kinds of injustices linked to this really corrupt business culture, and yet, whenever we want to talk about models of leadership, We talk about CEOs. I mean, I find it amazing. I mean, it's like inviting a convicted murderer, you know, to be your best man at a wedding, right? It just doesn't make any sense. And yet the culture of neoliberalism is so entrenched educationally that and so normalized that it becomes so difficult for people to think outside of this presupposition that the market is the only template for organizing, understanding, and intervening and defining oneself in society, that you know, it raises serious questions about where the sites are that are producing and legitimating and normalizing this kind of culture of greed dressed up as the culture of wisdom.
Oh, absolutely, Henry. There's no question in my mind that the crisis we're going through now did not happen by chance. This was well planned,
right,
and this was initiated by the corporate powers. The financial powers were the ones behind it. There were some other corporate folks that may have been hurt along the way. Or when they get hurt, if they're big enough, they get bailed out like GM and Chrysler were bailed out. No problem. No problem. You're going to go out of business? Well, we'll give you. How many billion do you need? Well, you've got it. You want another zero on this check? Well, we'll add another zero. We'll give you a little more, a little cushion, so you can be assured of your big bonuses as we bring you back from the dead. And this thing was planned. And the idea, an economist who's been on this program, Michael Hudson, he explains it brilliantly. And I mean, these people literally wanted to take the country down and exploit it so they could buy up competition on the cheap, so they could get rid of these useless eaters. You remember that phrase of Henry Kissinger? Get rid of these huge, I mean, who cares if these people die? I mean, get rid of them or leave. Anything. We don't need these people around. Let's get rid of them. They're useless. We don't want to waste resources on people like this. So we want to put people in duress, pick up their homes on the cheap, pick up other businesses that we want on the cheap. The ones that we don't want, we want them to go out of business so we can consolidate and get even bigger and bigger and bigger. And, I mean, they already own the world. What else do they want to own?
What's so interesting about this is, as you sort of, you know, always in a very, very eloquent way sort of explain this narrative, is that, you know, what's so significantly different about this post-1980s period and what went on before that, when we had at least a tiny modicum of the social state, right? I mean, we had the Great Society, we had the New Deal. I mean, we had the presupposition that the state in some way had to provide some kind of economic rights for people, because if you don't have economic rights, your social and political rights, your personal and political rights become relatively meaningless, right? I mean, if you have to engage in a daily struggle for survival, citizenship in itself becomes silly. It becomes inoperative. And so the forces of inequality play a very powerful role in shaping the kinds of opportunities that people have. What I find most interesting now, in terms of this kind of new authoritarianism that I write about in the book that we find ourselves in, is that not only is it organized around a culture of cruelty and a culture of lying, which has now become, and a culture of violence. I mean, Sarah Palin, for instance, killing an animal on her show with a high-powered rifle and sort of laughing about it. But there was a recent report in which, you know, these corporations are making huge amounts of profits, as you know. And in last month, 80% of all the workers who were hired were temps.
Oh, indeed so.
80%. I mean, the notion of the temp has become a kind of metaphor, right, for how we deal with people now who are seen as marginalized and disposable. I'll give you another example, and then we can play with this. For instance, in universities now, as you know, 70% of all faculty are either on a non-tenure track line or are just simply temporary adjuncts who work for slave wages. They've become the new subaltern class, right? Universities are now using temp agencies to hire these people. Yeah. People with PhDs are being hired by temp agencies. And I think it's a small window that kind of reflects in some fundamental way what the utter disregard and contempt that people now have for, that the corporations have for workers. that the corporation has for anybody who isn't flying in that circle of elites, sort of crisscrossing the globe with no political economic ties to anything, geographically, ethically, politically, except money. I mean, the only thing that matters is profit is the ultimate measure. It measures friendships. It measures how corporations work. It measures social investments. And yet, it seems to me, the way in which this is accelerating, at some point, you have to ask yourself, either we are going to move into a kind of fascism that's going to wrap itself in the flag, the kind of populism sort of promoted by the hysterical right, whether we're talking about Palin or Rush Limbaugh or Glenn Beck, or you're going to have a movement that is going to be capable of challenging this in ways that will have outlets for expressing its views. My biggest concern is that when you look at the media in this country, which has now become what C. Wright Mills calls the major cultural apparatus, right, the major educational force in the United States, it's controlled almost entirely by the right. Almost entirely. Frank Rich, in an editorial this week, he said, hey, look, for people who are claiming that the left and the right are simply two moments on the, on the extreme ideological spectrum are crazy. The right really has power. The left doesn't have power. But the left doesn't have access to the media. It doesn't have access to the new educational cultural apparatus. This is our problem. And this is one of the challenges that we're going to have to face, especially with the alternative media, because it's the only way we can do it.
Oh, there's no question.
If we can't do programs like yours, we can't multiply these programs so that they become a vast network and a public sphere in which ideas can be circulated outside of the what we might call the constraints of corporate power, we're going to lose. I mean, I have never in my life realized, as much as I do now at this late age in my life, how absolutely crucial this struggle over political agency actually is.
What really is, Henry, and I worry all the time that we're getting up in years, but what about the generation behind us? I'm thankful that I'm not in that generation.
I feel the same way. We have completely abandoned this generation. We have saddled them with debt. We have saddled them with unemployment. We have saddled them with a future in which the only thing that's going to matter is a kind of gladiatorial Darwinian world in which survival of the fittest will be the ultimate measure of whether one lives or dies in a society. That's not a society. That's the Roman Colosseum. That's casino capitalism. Oh. And it seems to me that we can't even imagine what it means to use youth as an ethical referent for talking about the future in some way that would reflect back on the utter irresponsibility of these people in Congress or these two parties or Obama, who seem to have no regard for young people. Young people actually have become the ultimate disposable population in many ways, and clearly it affects poor youth much different than it affects those youth who are privileged. But we are writing off generations of kids that one wonders what the avenues will be to politically mobilize them in light of the growing rates of illiteracy, in light of the growing rate of unemployment, in light of the fact that they now live in what we call death worlds, you know, death zones, meaning that these are liminal zones where the choices are so constrained that the only thing one can do is worry about surviving. You don't have lofty thoughts about what it means to be politically engaged, what it means to build a good society, build a good life for yourself, invest in ways in which you can imagine a future better than the one your parents had, or one for your children that will be better than the one you're constructing for yourself. Those days are being limited, and to the degree that we kill the imagination is a degree that we kill any sense of political agency.
Henry, every generation up through the end of the 1970s, the new generation bedded the one that preceded it. And since the age of Reagan, and it really began the last year or two of Jimmy Carter when he got more conservative, he was taking a beating, I guess, so he came around and hardened his views, deregulation and stuff like that. But up until that point, say the last 30 or so years, every generation from that point to now is worse off
than the one that preceded it.
That's exactly right.
And this is the direction that is continuing. And the only thing that the great majority of today's youths are good for, I hesitate to use a percentage, but what, 80%, 90%? The only thing they're good for, why bother educate them? Educating them. There are no good jobs for them. You don't need a good job to go to work part-time for Walmart or McDonald's or anything in the service area where you don't need a lot of skills. Whatever you need, they'll instruct you a day or two, and just go ahead and do what you got to do.
I'll tell you, but there's an interesting point to be made there, because you're absolutely right. I mean, there is no point in educating them, but at the same time, at least educating them in terms of getting a credential that becomes worthless. But at the same time, there are two issues here at work that I think are potentially explosive, politically explosive. And one is, if we can reclaim education as a public sphere, the importance of which is to promote public values and civic integrity and civic courage, and educate kids to make power accountable, right? I'm for that. I mean, I think that when education is defended as a vital public service that in ways prepares people to be political agents and to in some way have some control over the forces that are going to inform their lives, I'll take that rationale for education any day over a notion of education that's purely instrumentalized and can only imagine training workers, which is what the Arne Duncans of the world want to do. So in that view of education is dangerous. But at the same time, it seems to me there's an enormous disconnect between understanding the political importance of that view and recognizing that we are investing in a war machine and in a punishing state that has now cost over $3 trillion since, of course, the beginning of the war in Iraq, that if you took that money and put it into education, we could send every young person in this country to graduate to get an undergraduate degree for free. For free. And it seems to me they're the kinds of struggles we've got to mobilize young people around and adults around. We've got to say, hey, look, we have lost the social state. It's being dismantled. We are building a punishing state. Many problems are now simply being criminalized rather than being addressed. Instead of a war on poverty, we now have a war on the poor. Where's the money going to come from to reclaim a legacy of the New Deal and the social state and social democracy that can actually make this country more democratic, that can provide a future for people? So it's really around not just wresting control from the corporate elite. It's also around understanding what the shifting of priorities would mean in terms of a future and a set of investments that would actually be recognizable. Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes a lot of sense. I was going to add that besides low-paid part-time workers with no benefits, the other job that they want the great majority of kids for, Henry, is to go in the military to feed our war machine. So our tax dollars feed the war machine. That's the money part of it.
We don't talk enough about one side of this. I mean, I'm very appreciative of the fact that many on the left talk about the increasing corporatization of the United States. I mean, Chomsky's fabulous on this. We know who they all are. You have them all on your show. But I think the other side of this is that we also have the rise of something called the punishing state. The state is not going away. It's just being transformed. And I think this becomes a really serious issue that we've got to address. I mean, it's not – the corporatization is an evil in itself, but the underside of corporatization is controlling disposable populations that now pose a threat in some way to these rich corporate elite. And you have to have institutions. The notion of the police, right, the notion of the criminal justice system now becomes the default for all forms of social problems, so that we don't deal with poverty, we arrest kids and we put them in prison. When black and poor white kids violate a rule in school, like a dress code, we don't send them to the guidance teacher, we handcuff them and we bring them to a criminal justice court. You see what's happening here, this kind of way in which the punishing state starts to move out, so that the model of the prison, in terms of its values, in terms of governing through crime, in terms of the insistence on punishment, begins to interface and affect almost every sphere of life. That seems to go unnoticed in this country.
It sure does. Henry, it's no accident that we have the largest prison population in the world. Not per capita, but the largest prison population in the world. And I have a feeling that the numbers may even be understated. When I mention it, I use the number 2.4 million. I've seen other reports that say 2.3. But we got them offshore. We get them stuffed in all kinds of places.
Right.
Got them, what we do to so-called undocumented immigrants is an atrocity. And we even incarcerate them in warehouses where there are no beds and there are no facilities of any kind. It's like sticking somebody in an abandoned warehouse and you lock the doors and they can't get out and you keep them there till you decide what you want to do with them.
I mean, I'm convinced actually in part that the anti-immigration fervor being mobilized by corporate elites and political elites in throughout the United States is actually linked to the for-profit prison industry. I mean, I think that in many ways that's one of the fastest-growing segments of the criminal justice system. And as Angela Davis, you know, that the wonderful, beautiful, great Angela Davis has pointed out, that prison population now, rather than being 2.4, as you suggest, as you're suggesting, is much more. She claims it's somewhere around 7 million.
Well, if you include people on parole, Henry, absolutely. I mean, the numbers are staggering and so skewed toward the poor in the country, mostly black and Latinos, mostly young men, and two-thirds of the prison population, half of it is black, and add Latinos, it's about two-thirds. Half of the total population in prison is for nonviolent offenses. About half of that is drug-related. You know, you have a marijuana joint in your pocket and get caught, and they can put you in prison.
It's incarceration nation. I mean, you were talking about the per capita stats, you know, and I was thinking to myself, I mean, think about this. In the U.S., if you go with the 2.3 million figure, right, not even, you know, the figures we're talking about, you're talking about 700 per 100,000 citizens in the U.S. compared to China, which has 110 per 100,000. France has 80 per 100,000, and Saudi Arabia has 45 per 100,000. Mm-hmm. I mean, welcome to democracy.
I've seen those numbers.
You go
all the way down the European or OAS countries, and the numbers are double digit, and then they skyrocket. You have some countries, you get to Russia, I think, is number two to us. You get to a handful that are triple digit, and then you get to us, and we have this monstrous number of people per capita, per 100,000, in our prison system, and they're all poor kids, mostly black, mostly Latino, and we lock them up and put them away. And another big part of that for me, Henry, is the number of political prisoners. People who aren't poor, whatever their color. These are people who are activists. They could be human rights people of some kind or other. They can be even lawyers. And I mentioned yesterday that a lawyer I happen to know personally, Lynn Stewart, glorious human rights lawyer, she was convicted for defending an unpopular client too vigorously. That was her crime. And she got a 10-year sentence. It was a resentence, which may turn out to be a death sentence because her health right now is good, but it's not perfect. And she's gone through breast cancer. She had a surgery since she's been in prison in the past year. She was just transferred to an awful place. She was in a New York City jail for a little over a year. And yesterday the word came out that she was transferred to a so-called a medical prison for female inmates, but it may be more like a chamber of horrors because the way they treat people there, they all too often, the women who go in there are brutalized. Now, whether this will happen to Lynn or not, I sure hope not, but it's very worrisome.
I mean, I think that we're seeing two things that is very interesting. You know, we're seeing a new media that's exploding and in some way puncturing the dominant narratives of the corporate and political criminals, right? And all of a sudden, I think the punishing state has now intervened in a way. I mean, WikiLeaks, you know, this poor young kid who just turned 25, you know, who's in jail because he supplied information to WikiLeaks. I mean, the notion that knowledge is not just power, but the notion that knowledge is actually a threat to power, which is something we don't talk about, you know, has all of a sudden become central to the way the state is now cracking down on dissidents. And I don't think there's a more obvious place to see that than in the universities in the U.S. I mean, it becomes increasingly difficult to say anything that's a matter of dissent. I mean, you know, there was a point in our lives when we, in our generation, your generation and mine, when you actually believed that kids went to school to actually learn more than what they know. Now the point is, if they go to school to learn more than what they know, that's indoctrination, right? So we have to take all this power away from, you know, from teachers, from professors, from educators, so that they can only teach the dominant narrative. And if they don't, then all of a sudden they're not bad teachers, they're simply unpatriotic, and we dismiss them. And it seems to me that that assault on critical thought, coupled with the assault on any institutional form that benefits workers, the poor, whether we're talking about social services, whether we're talking about unions. I mean, we have to connect the dots between these various assaults and ask ourselves, what is it that they're trying to destroy? I mean, they're not just trying to destroy workers and unions. They're trying to destroy the very possibility of what makes a democracy work. And that is the ability to think beyond dominant narratives, the ability to act in those narratives, to struggle for them, and to in some way imagine what it might mean to live in the unimaginable, in the not yet, as Hannah Arendt once said. And it seems to me that's what this is about. And we've got to recognize that, for instance, it's not just about high tuition or low tuition in higher education. That's not an insignificant issue, for sure. But the real issue is the university and other public spheres that even offer the possibility of critical thought are now being criminalized. They're not just being corporatized, they're being criminalized.
Oh, they sure are being criminalized. Oh, dear, imagine, Henry, that we might have a government that at least enough was a government doing things for us. We have never had a perfect government in our entire history, even going back to the best times we ever had under the so-called best leaders. And even an FDR at his best, and he certainly wasn't at his best when he first came into office in 1932. I mean, he was more Hoover than Roosevelt back then. But after a couple of years, he realized that we were really in very dire shape. And there were even some enlightened CEOs back then who agreed with him. And one of them was General Electric. They were very worried that public anger might get so intense that there could be some very serious trouble, overt trouble against the system. So, I mean, we got the New Deal. We got some wonderful things that happened in the New Deal, and it became an essential thing to put people back to work. What's more important than putting people back to work to get the economy growing, so whatever temporary job, you go to work on a road project because industry isn't hiring anybody, but if the economy can recover, then these jobs will come back. And they did come back. And we had a very strong manufacturing base during World War II and for decades after that. And then it began eroding when we exported our best jobs overseas, including our service jobs, too. I mean, anybody can be a programmer. You can be on the moon and be a programmer as easily as sitting in a plush office in New York City.
But I think that, you know, what's interesting about that argument is what's changed, right? It seems to me that in the 1920s, in the 1930s, in the 1940s, you had a couple of things going on. Internationally, you had a socialist and communist movement that, in fact, was embodied in often terribly distorted ways in various states. You also had a strong union. You had socialist movements. You had workers' organizations in the United States. And in many ways, both the New Deal and the Great Society were a response to those. They saw those as a threat. And they wanted to, in some way, appropriate some of the more liberal dimensions of those movements in order to prevent more radical movements from emerging. What I find interesting now is that the arrogance and the concentration of power, coupled with the arrogance of power, coupled with a now global elite that has no allegiance, it seems to me, to the nation state whatsoever, no allegiance to matters of specificity, all of a sudden, that power is so concentrated, the arrogance so profound, that they don't see any threats at all by which they have to modify their position. So when we talk about corporations now making more money than they ever have before, and yet spending less to hire workers, we get a sense of how the zombie politics works, right? We get a sense of how it lives off really the dead. I mean, it promotes a kind of death culture, a form of social death for most workers, for many people. And at the same time, it's unaccountable. It's completely unaccountable. You know, this stuff that we now hear about how, Obama has really done well in compromising. Ismail Reed wrote a piece, an op-ed in the New York Times that I thought was despicable the other day, in which he actually argues that, well, you know, one of the reasons that Obama, white people, progressives don't understand that Obama as a black man just can't get angry. Well, I don't know about that. I mean, what I think Obama can't do is actually exhibit the kind of courage that is necessary to not promote anti-democratic forces. This isn't about whether he wants to get angry. This is about his politics. His politics are deplorable. And let's name those politics. And it seems to me that when compromise works in ways to simply strengthen dominant relations of power in the corporate elite, then it seems to me Obama has to be accountable. And we have to stop talking about how he's doing his best under bad circumstances. The fact of the matter is he's one of them. The fact of the matter is we need a third party in this country. The fact of the matter is we need social movements to be able to think beyond centrist politics. We need to stop equating capitalism with democracy. It doesn't work.
It sure doesn't work. And Obama is sure one of them. And he was picked out for big things many, many years ago. I think he was first spotted, and the grooming may have begun when he was back in college and then in law school.
Yeah, right.
And unlike Bush, Bush got through top schools because of his father. Obama is no dummy. I mean, he's got a brain, and I can't imagine getting through. Maybe you can get. I can't imagine how you can get through Yale and Harvard Business School without even a little bit of a brain, let alone not even showing up. But I don't know how much of a brain Bush has, but I think a lot of times he didn't show up, just like he was AWOL in the Air National Guard.
My friend Chris Hedges has a take on this that I like. You know, he talks about how this type of education, with its emphasis on privilege, with its emphasis on a kind of cultural capital that seems to believe that the best and the brightest are the aristocrats of both intelligence and civic courage, he completely dismantles that. And he talks about how they're basically educated to be selfish. They're basically educated in a cultural capital that despises workers and working class people, that they have become educated to be so arrogant and narrow in their basic political, ethical, and civic interest that, in fact, they become stupid. But he does something else. And he says the real question about the kind of education that Obama got, and this is not really about refusing to be an angry black man. This is about the cultural capital that he's absorbed. And it seems to me the question now becomes, what does he need to unlearn? To what degree do you need to unlearn what you get from that kind of education? What do you need to unlearn in order to appreciate solidarity, in order to appreciate social justice, in order to take democracy seriously, in order to recognize human suffering when it appears? I mean, when I write in this book about the best and the brightest, you know, who are always sort of wrapped in the mantle of high culture, right? These are the people who gave us Vietnam. These are the people who gave us Iraq. These are the people who gave us the economic recession. These are the people who use drones with people piloting them in Los Angeles somewhere in some dark room killing unknowing civilians. So I'm not buying this best and the brightest stuff. I'm not buying the presupposition that if you read Proust that you somehow are guaranteed a kind of political imagination on the side of democracy. I think it's one of the worst and most dangerous presuppositions that we have in this country about the elite. And I think it's something that we need to consistently dismantle and recognize it for what it's worth.
Well, it's not worth anything that you and I believe in, Henry. And as far as what has gone on recently that has absolutely obsessed me economically, the so-called Obama compromise, well, it absolutely was no compromise. It was unconditional surrender. And all of this huffing and puffing and toing and froing that went on for day after day, and again, the high-minded rhetoric, I think the deal was cut long before we heard about it. And the Republicans wanted the tax cuts because they're rich. Because they're rich. Obama is a multimillionaire. Top people in the two-thirds of the Senate are multimillionaires. You think these people wanted to give up their tax breaks? Not in your life. In the House.
You know what I think, Stephen? I think that the Supreme Court provided the rich and the powerful and the corporate elite and the zombies, the political zombies, with a new lease on life. Because that recent ruling that said that they can now provide unlimited amounts of money to politicians without having to be accountable for where that money comes from, I think that what the tax law did was it suggested the degree to which the bought politicians in both the liberals and the conservatives are now even more indebted to the rich. They have to, I mean, they're just bending over, and they will consistently bend over around the question of policy to make sure that every law, every piece of legislation ultimately is judged by the degree to which it benefits the corporate wealthy and rich individuals in the United States, the upper 1%. That's exactly what politics has become. It's become a boys' club. And that boys' club now operates in a dead zone in which it has no interest in doing anything but expanding the form of death in life, a kind of social death, right, where they just live off the vast majority of the labor, the earnings, the sentiments, the hopes, the dreams of most of the people in the United States. It's a democracy that now is shrouded in a kind of zombie-like nature in which it feeds off the worst impulses of the most, how might we say it, the most dangerous form of authoritarianism, because it's not about goose-stepping black shirts in the streets. It's about convincing people that it's in their best interest to basically destroy all the institutions and social protections that would give them the possibility of actually being able to run the government and the country they live in.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, Henry. And again, this just grates at me all the time. It generates an awful lot of material that I want to get down on paper and share with other people, and programs like having you on today to talk about this, because we're literally seeing our country veer so far in the wrong direction, and human beings, mass numbers of millions of human beings being destroyed, whether we do it economically or socially or grind them in our war machine. And I mean, what kind of a country is this? And the rich and powerful are the ones that support this and keep it going. And there's a bad ending to this, but nobody worries about that because they're living the good life right now. They're profiting from it, and maybe there'll be a problem at some future time, but that'll be for someone else to worry about, not them. So as long as the good times are rolling, they want to roll with them, and it doesn't matter. The immorality or immorality, I don't know what you call it, but it simply is unimportant. How many people get hurt by this? That is not the issue. The only issue is that they do well, and if it means that millions of people have to suffer or die or whatever, well, that's okay. There's a small price to pay as long as they do well. That infamous quote by Madeleine Albright when 60 Minutes asked her about the Iraqi sanctions killing half a million children, and she referred to it as I forget her exact words, but it was a price worth paying in her mind.
it actually marks a certain point in which neoliberalism reveals the depthlessness of its own conscience, right? I mean, a kind of insensitivity, not just to human life, but to the lives of children, I mean, which is even more compelling in some ways, although all human life is sacred. But when children who are defenseless all of a sudden are slaughtered upon the altar of war and profit, and we have no language to in some way counter that, but actually arrogantly defend it through the logic of expediency, political and military expediency, you know you have moved into a different world, right? You know that you have moved away from a democracy to such a point that the ideals that once offered at least a check on that kind of symbolic and material violence no longer exist. Or it's become default, or it's become defunct, or it simply is seen as something antiquated. I mean, one of the things that I in this book that I'm particularly concerned about, you know, is I'm concerned about how the question of violence symbolically and materially now has moved into a kind of realm of the spectacle, you know, in which everywhere you look, you see the most grotesque forms of violence being celebrated, and how that becomes now part of a political order that actually mobilizes people and actually mobilizes political movements. I mean, when you look at the Tea Party movement, you look at Sarah Palin talking about locking and reloading and locking. You know, these military, I mean, maybe the way in which the limits of violence are constantly being pushed back, so that we're so close to stepping over into a state in which violence becomes the only measure in which politics can be justified, in which the state can be legitimated, in which schools can function, in which business organizations are able to defend what they do. That's troubling, right? I mean, it's troubling because it suggests the death of a certain kind of political literacy. And it seems to me that with that death comes the inability for any kind of collective self-reflection. And so the question becomes, how does this literacy get challenged? I mean, where are the spaces where we can take this up? I mean, clearly programs like this, clearly ultimately in some sections of the new media. But when you live in a society that has moved from a society of production to a society of consumption, and people, and the only obligation of citizenship is consuming, as you've suggested earlier, it becomes more difficult for people to imagine themselves as exercising any kind of solidarity outside of meeting people at the mall.
Well, how true. And, Henry, you remember I forget the moment in time, but you remember when we were going through some economic problems, and it might have been after the dot-com bust, and we had the recession of the early part of this decade, and Bush suggested, I forget, it was either that, or the war started at that time, too, October of 2001, and Bush suggested that that the solution to our problems was go out and shop.
I know. I have a very vivid memory of that. I mean, wasn't that where he was standing in New York with the firemen in that famous photo in which he said, "Look, it's going to be okay. Just go shopping."
You know, I don't remember where he was, but I sure remember that photo op in New York with the firemen. He may have said it there, but again,
yeah, of course, the important point is that was his only solution. I mean, in response to 9/11, he's telling people to go shopping. It's like absurd, right? I mean, that truly is part of a kind of zombie politics that is almost unimaginable, isn't it?
Oh, it really is.
Again, but in the face of massive death and destruction, in the face of the necessity for a kind of self-examination of one's foreign policy, in light of what it might mean to now all of a sudden come to and develop some degree of understanding of these forces that need to be contended with, we tell people to go shopping. I mean, it just is mind-blowing to me. I mean, it suggests something about a politics of what my friend Stanley Aronowitz has called the politics of disconnect, this utter disconnect between the rhetoric and the reality, whether it's Bush or Obama. The disconnect is overwhelming, right? Or even Arne Duncan, do you believe this, who says things like, these educational reforms that we're putting through, you know, privatization, the push for charter schools, you know, the attack on teachers' unions, this is the great civil rights movement of the 21st century. How's that one?
Oh, you know, I think I missed that phrase, but I mean... Oh, my goodness. I don't know how those words got out of his mouth.
Who, after Katrina, you know this, right?
Oh, yeah.
Arne Duncan, who said Katrina was a great thing because we were able to rebuild the school system by basically privatizing it.
That's exactly what they did, and the people who suffered through that horror, most of them have not. They were dispossessed. They were sent away from the city, and a good many. I think most of them have not been allowed to come back.
Well, I think that the tragedy there is that what we saw in Katrina was not just the absolute breakdown of the social state, but we also saw the emergence of the racialized punishing state, right? And we saw the emergence of a kind of a racialized media that was so cruel and contemptible in its blaming poor people for actually the absolute irresponsibility of the Bush administration, that you got once again a sense not just simply of the persistence of racism in the United States, but you got a sense of actually a more vile and horrible kind of racism that seems to cloud itself or wrap itself in this assumption that people are ultimately only responsible for themselves and whatever problems they have to face, whether they're black, poor, yellow, or otherwise, they ultimately will have to share the blame for. I mean, it's just a despicable philosophy.
It really is, Henry. And again, I wonder when will people begin reacting, because if we don't do something in our own self-interest, this will just keep getting worse and worse, and you and I won't live long enough to see the train wreck that will come at some point in time. But how many millions of people have to be ground up in this terrible, destructive machine before people realize that those people running the country, that evil cabal, that corporate government cabal, we need a new name. It's not even fair to call them government. It's just a machine that they work together with big. It's big money, and they have their agents that I like to think aren't elected, but they're installed in the right positions to do their bidding.
But I think again, I want to go back to something you keep saying that I like, but I think we need to build on, and that is when you say, "How long before people will recognize?" Right? That's not just a political commentary. That's the call for a pedagogical intervention. And it seems to me that when we start to take seriously, at the very least, and something that would be central to any viable form of politics, is the recognition that we have to struggle over creating the educational conditions throughout the society that will enable people to understand those contradictions and translate them into progressive social movements. I mean, if we don't do that, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. I mean, you know, I think of people like Michael Lerner at Tikkun, right, who, in the face of the most abominable atrocities, this is a saintly man. I mean, organizes conferences. Tikkun is constantly sort of pushing issues up front, doing everything it can to get people to mobilize. That's the side we have to point to. We have to consistently point to models where people who are under the radar, and I mean under the radar not in terms of being politically effective, but under the radar in that in this society controlled by a right-wing media, a conservative media, they just don't get any attention. I think we also have to bring attention to these groups, to these movements, to these youth struggles, you know, groups that are really doing everything they can and to organize in different ways. We can't allow them to sink into the black hole that has become, you know, or these dead zones that are now constrained and organized by organized power and organized governments. Black sites. The new black sites are not just prisons, you know, offshore prisons. The black sites are also the blackouts. The blackouts that prevent people from recognizing that real struggles are going on, that people like Chomsky, that all kinds of Howards in the past, Stanley Aronowitz, you know, that there's a wealth of information out there, there's a wealth of resources and social movements, and that the key is to make them visible, and the key is to bring them together.
Well, absolutely, and I must say, in one of my articles, Henry, I took issue with Rabbi Lerner because he had a New York Times editorial. He's an Obama supporter, and the best he could come up with all we're going through, with our governments under Obama betraying us, the best he could come up with was we need a challenge in 2012, a challenge to his presidency, another candidate.
I think going beyond that. I think Michael is a fast learner, and my emphasis on Michael is that Michael, like a lot of people, you know, that I mean, Michael's heart is in the right place, and if his politics are not what we want them to be, at least I see in individuals like Michael and groups like Michael a constant transformation towards a more viable and a more progressive politics, and that gives me hope.
Well, he certainly is on the right side of the fence. At this stage of the game, Henry, I can't imagine why anybody with a reasonable degree of intelligence doesn't realize that Obama and the Democrats have betrayed us the same way as Bush and the Republicans.
I'm with you on that. I think that Obama is wrapped in the myth of a rhetoric that is as deceitful as it is disingenuous.
It absolutely is. And the only way to bring him back, I don't want to challenge in 2012. I want to push by us that this is what we need, and this is what we want, and this is what we demand. And if you don't give it to us, then we're going to find another way to get it, because we're not going to continue going on the way we have been. That's the kind of challenge that I want, just with a mass grassroots groundswell that we know who you are. We know what you're doing. We don't like it. And we demand that it be changed. Henry, the time goes by so fast. Oh, my goodness. I wish you the best. I'd like to wish somebody a happy holiday and say, you know, we really have something to give thankful for this year. Well, maybe next year. The old Red Sox moan that I remember as a boy growing up, wait till next year. Wait. Well, they say the same thing in Chicago, as a matter of fact. Henry, my great thanks for coming on. I look forward. You have a couple of more books that we need to talk about on air. We can talk about that, scheduling you.
And,
we'll get into the new year. It's almost at the end of this one. I look forward to getting you back again and continuing this discussion. It's so important, and we need to arouse people who I hope, Henry, will go out and arouse others. We don't reach millions in this program. We reach thousands. Maybe those thousands will arouse thousands more. If the ball keeps going, then maybe we can get enough momentum going for the kind of change that we have to have.
I think that's the part of the Christmas spirit I like.
Again, Henry, many thanks.
Thank you, sir.
My computer just went down. I have to figure out what's wrong. As soon as I get it back up again, I'll shoot you an email.
Okay.
Thanks, Henry.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And join us again tomorrow.